Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio and a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. An interview with Israeli journalist Shani Rosanis. She talks about Israel denying the UN declaration of a man-made famine in Palestine and the classified Israeli military report that showed that 83% of killed Palestinians were civilians. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
A UN-backed global hunger monitor has declared a famine in Gaza City, warning that 500,000 people are living in catastrophic conditions. The IPC Crisis Prevention Group says a quarter of Gaza's population is facing starvation after 22 months of war. Conditions are expected to worsen, with the famine area likely to widen next month. Israel says the report is based on Hamas lies. Well, with me here in the studio is DW Middle East analyst Shani Rosanis. Shani, great to have you here. So how do you expect the IPC report to impact the Israeli government or its policies in Gaza?
Well, on the surface, the first immediate response we've seen from the prime minister is that this is calling it an outright riot. You know, we've seen the COGAT, the government arm that is in charge of coordination of supply and aid into Gaza, also with a very long report claiming this is based on lies. That is, you know, the UN is completely ignoring all the actions of the American Foundation, the GHF, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and many other efforts that Israel has been taking in the last months. So, on the surface, it seems like Israelis are convinced to go on the way they have. But we do know that in the last months, these pictures, the data, the information coming out of Gaza of clear famine, of clear hunger, is affecting Israel in the sense that it changed its policy. It had allowed even humanitarian, for humanitarian pauses of ceasefire, just letting, you know, ensuring that there's more aid coming in a safer way because of the pressure that was coming from the world. So despite the fact Israel tried to claim it's UN propaganda and it's all Hamas orchestrated campaign, it is affecting Israel. Even now when we're seeing Israel trying to talk about expanding its operations in Gaza, taking over the city of Gaza, one of the most important things it needs to fulfill before moving on militarily is trying to take care of aid and the population in Gaza. So, of course, it makes a difference, though not the difference that maybe the UN would expect it to make.
Now, we've seen also this week an investigation by several media outlets, and they've been citing figures from a classified Israeli military database showing that 83% of the people killed in the Gaza war were civilians. Now, that represents 5 out of 6 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. So could you tell us more about this?
Yes, this is a report that we were mentioning. It's based on data from the Israeli intelligence units that have basically a very detailed list of Gazan citizens and mostly of Gazan militants. Some of them are, most of them connected to Hamas, some of them connected to Islamic Jihad. And what they, and each one of them is basically, what we're seeing this list is the Israeli military keeping score over who has been hit by Israeli forces. And the total number that this document is showing stands at about 9,000 militants who have been killed in Gaza by Israeli forces. This is far less than the total number of 20,000 that Netanyahu himself has been pointing out to, and is, you know, sometimes even saying thousands of militants. Why does it matter? It matters because we know the general number, the total number of casualties in Gaza. And Israel keeps saying that this, the civilian death, you know, the civilian death toll is actually lower because a very big chunk of it is militants. What this document is showing is that Israel's claims are actually not substantiated. It's showing that Israel's own numbers actually indicate that the numbers of militants that were killed was fewer, meaning that the civilian casualties are far higher than Israel was willing to admit so far.
Now, Shani, you keep a close eye, of course, on what's going on in Israel and the media there and what's being said. So what's the reaction been to all of this that we've been discussing today?
Well, you would imagine or you would like to hope that this would be something that is, you know, breaking news for Israeli channels. But what we've been seeing systematically since October 7th, almost 2 years now, that the Israeli public is very much still in its own bubble, does very little about the horrors of Gaza that, you know, makes it into the Israeli public. And when it does, it's usually, of course, being seen as, you know, Hamas propaganda, and anybody, any Israelis who try to show solidarity with Gaza or objection to the war is quickly being referred to as a traitor or, you know, playing into the hands of Hamas. This is a this is partly why we might not be seeing enough of response from the Israeli population as the world would like to see. The Israelis are still very much busy with themselves and their grief over October 7th.
All right, we're going to leave it there, Shani, but great to have your analysis this morning. Shani Vrazanis, DW Middle East analyst. Thank you.
That interview and analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Israeli strikes on a Gaza hospital Monday killed at least 20 people, including 5 journalists. Over 350,000 Israelis demonstrated in Tel Aviv on Tuesday, demanding Netanyahu accept the ceasefire agreed to by Hamas. NHK Japan.
Israeli strikes on a Gaza hospital on Monday left at least 20 people dead, including 5 journalists. The international community has criticized the attack. Some say it may have been what's called a double tap, in which the same place is targeted twice to maximize casualties. Authorities in Gaza say Nasser Hospital in the southern city of Khan Yunis was hit. The victims reportedly include 5 journalists who worked for Reuters, Al Jazeera, and other media outlets. Many victims were said to have been killed by the second strike after they gathered at the site following the first one. This video was taken shortly after the first attack. Medical workers and journalists can be seen on the stairs of the hospital. A second explosion suddenly occurred during the rescue operations. The Israeli military admitted to attacking the hospital and expressed regret over the civilian deaths. It said it's investigating the matter. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in a statement that civilians, including medical personnel and journalists, must be respected and protected at all times. He demanded a prompt and impartial investigation. French President Emmanuel Macron called the attack intolerable in a social media post. He also said civilians and journalists must be protected under all circumstances.
Relatives of hostages held in Gaza have protested to demand the Israeli government sign a ceasefire deal so their loved ones can be freed. Families of hostages and their supporters organized a massive rally in Tel Aviv on Tuesday. They say more than 350,000 people took part. Protesters called on the government to accept a ceasefire proposal already agreed to by Hamas that includes the release of some hostages. The Israeli government has signaled it plans to seize Gaza City to increase pressure on Hamas. Another demonstration took place in Jerusalem in front of the home of the cabinet minister in charge of the ceasefire talks.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. On shortwave, they're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is also found at most podcast sites. On to France 24. A press review on UK Prime Minister hopeful Nigel Farage, who says he would deport 600,000 migrants if in office. The UN ambassador to France accused the French government of supporting anti-Semitism. Denmark public broadcaster DR reported that three Americans with connections to Trump have been covertly trying to shape how Greenlanders think about a U.S. annexation. Much of the European Union is experiencing a record drought and an early onset autumn. Ukrainian drone bombing of Russian refineries has created gasoline shortages in the country. Venezuelan President Maduro raged about the presence of three U.S. warships reportedly carrying 4,500 troops off the coast of his country. France 24.
In the UK, the papers seem to be picking up on Nigel Farage's migration plan.
Yeah, most of the British front pages also covering Farage's speech yesterday. The Daily Express here summing it up with one quote, "I will deport 600,000 illegal migrants." The right-wing politician unveiled his Operation Restoring Justice, a migration plan he pledges to execute if he becomes Prime Minister. Now, this article says that Farage wants to copy Donald Trump's mass deportation program by ordering immigration enforcement teams to carry out raids across the country. The Daily Mirror voicing their outrage on their front page, "Britain is better than this." This is a quote taken from their opinion piece by Paul Routledge. The Mirror's political editor traces back the history of right-wing politicians playing the migration card. The Telegraph also covering this story, but with a slightly unexpected headline, "Taliban to give Farage deal on migrants." The reform leader has suggested sending people back to Afghanistan, and the article says that the Taliban have declared themselves ready and willing to work with Farage. The reform leader would have to leave the European Court of Human Rights, though, to reach his deportation targets.
Ahead of the 81st anniversary of the liberation of Paris, which ended the deportation of French Jews, the U.S. ambassador to France marked the day with a warning. In a letter leaked to American press Sunday, Charles Kushner accused French President Emmanuel Macron of failing to tackle anti-Semitism, calling it a stain that has long scarred French life.
In France, not a day passes without Jews assaulted in the street, synagogues or schools defaced, or Jewish-owned businesses vandalized. Your own interior ministry has reported anti-Semitic incidents, even at preschools.
Just hours later, France's foreign ministry hit back, summoning Kushner and calling the allegations unacceptable.
They contravene international law, in particular the duty not to interfere in the internal affairs of states, as provided for in the 1961 Vienna Convention governing diplomatic relations.
Kushner is Jewish, and his son is married to U.S. President Donald Trump's daughter Ivanka. His letter echoes comments by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who last week accused the French president of fueling anti-Semitism by backing recognition of a Palestinian state. Kushner also wrote,
"Gestures towards recognition of a Palestinian state embolden extremists, fuel violence, and endanger Jewish life in France."
Nearly 2 years into the war in Gaza, France plans to join other countries in formally acknowledging Palestinian statehood next month at the UN General Assembly. Macron made the announcement in July, saying peace was possible and there was no alternative. He has previously called anti-Semitism contrary to French values and boosted security at synagogues and Jewish sites across France.
The United States' official presence in Greenland may look unassuming, but behind the scenes, Washington is reportedly trying a clandestine approach to expanding its influence in the territory. That's according to Danish public broadcaster DR, quoting unnamed government and security sources, who believe that at least three Americans with connections to Donald Trump have been carrying out covert influence operations to try and shape how people in Greenland think.
It's important that we gain some insight into this so that our populations, both Greenland and Denmark, know what we are up against. This is inherently completely unacceptable, and therefore, in light of the information that has emerged, I've decided to summon the American Chargé d'Affaires.
The AR reports that the operation included compiling a list of US-friendly Greenlanders, collecting names of people opposed to Trump, and researching cases that could be used to cast Denmark in a bad light. DR said it had been unable to clarify whether the Americans were working under orders, but from threats of annexation to sending J.D. Vance and Trump Jr. to try and woo the locals, the U.S. president has made no secret to the fact he wants the mineral-rich, strategically located Arctic island one way or the other.
Working with everybody involved to try and get it.
We must remember that it is Greenland itself that must decide what we want, what kind of future we choose, and the order of the partners we choose to work with. And the United States will always be one of them, but I think it is important to be increasingly skeptical the more we hear about attempts to influence us in Greenland.
Denmark insists that Greenland will decide its future itself. According to a January poll, most of its people want to become independent, but do not wish to become part of the U.S.
It appears to already be autumn in this southern France forest. Trees now painted orange, leaves dried out and falling weeks ahead of time.
It's very clear that the foliage is completely dry, and the question is, will they really recover? I think it's a difficult time for them.
It's the result of months of relentless drought. Since spring, barely a drop of rain has fallen here, a reality mirrored across much of France. Farmers are struggling too.
There's a lot of dry grass, and cows won't eat it. It's dead grass.
But the crisis stretches far beyond France. During the first 10 days of August, the European Drought Observatory found more than half of Europe and the Mediterranean basin suffering from drought, the highest level recorded since data collection started in 2012. And conditions have only worsened as wildfires continue to rage across the region.
Extreme weather events are becoming increasingly severe due to global warming. And unfortunately, we will have to deal with this, not just tomorrow, but in the months and years to come.
Forecasters warn long overdue September rains won't end the drought, but they could ease its intensity. A reprieve farmers and forests alike are desperately waiting for.
In one of the world's top oil-producing countries, cars are lined up outside fueling stations as pumps run dry. Russia is seeing gasoline shortages in several regions, including Ukrainian territory it's captured or annexed. Wholesale prices for top-grade petrol hit record highs last week, 50% above their January level. Ordinary Russians are feeling the pinch. Authorities have already banned gasoline exports. That ban now extended through the end of October in a bid to bring domestic prices down. Behind the shortages, Ukrainian military strikes on Russian oil refineries, as Kyiv seeks to raise the stakes on Moscow ahead of potential peace negotiations pushed for by U.S. President Donald Trump. Both sides have stepped up attacks on each other's energy infrastructure, but Ukrainian drones have been marking increased success, hitting 10 Russian facilities in recent weeks.
What Ukrainians are doing, they are attacking an arc of refineries, starting from Ryazan, which is south of Moscow, and all the way to Volgograd.
The strikes are estimated to have disrupted 17% of Russia's refining capacity, equivalent to around 1.1 million barrels of oil per day. The resulting shortages hitting amid a period of high demand as farmers prepare for the fall harvest, with tourists on the road to home from summer vacation. The drop in refining capacity, meanwhile, is forcing Russia to push more of its crude oil towards exports, a tricky task as Washington pressures its top customers, India and China, to reduce their purchases. Moscow relies on energy exports for a quarter of its budget revenues.
On Friday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro railed against the U.S.'s deployment of three warships off the coast of his country sent to combat alleged drug trafficking.
What they're threatening to do against Venezuela, regime change, a military terrorist attack, is immoral, criminal, and illegal.
Maduro is accused of narco-terrorism and conspiring to negotiate shipments of cocaine produced by the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. Anonymous sources have told the news agency Reuters that three American ships deployed this week could arrive off the coast of Venezuela as early as Saturday. The sources said the ships were carrying 4,500 military service members, including over 2,000 Marines. Maduro has ordered the deployment of 4.5 million militia members across Venezuela this weekend to prepare a response to the perceived U.S. threat and called for public rallies against Washington. Throughout the week, a number of Latin American and Caribbean countries, including Colombia and Cuba, have condemned the naval deployment off Venezuela's coast as a threat to regional peace and stability.
Those reports were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English and most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this listener-funded program, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show, which is supplied without cost to more than 100 radio stations across the globe. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba is worried as well about the arrival of U.S. military vessels off the coast of Venezuela. Massive protests to end the war on Palestine swept across 40 cities in Australia last Sunday. Over 200 former European Union ambassadors and officials signed a new open letter urging the European Union to take tougher action against Israel. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Cuban Minister of Foreign Affairs, Bruno Rodriguez, expressed his concern over the threat to peace in Latin America posed by the deployment of U.S. military vessels in the Caribbean Sea. On his X account, Rodriguez claimed that the United States' deployment of additional military vessels is an attempt to reassert its influence in the region, disguised as a campaign against drug trafficking. In this regard, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Ivan Hill criticized the American government for its efforts to destabilize the entire region of Latin America. His comments were prompted by reports of naval deployments purportedly aimed at combating drug trafficking and the accusations leveled against President Nicolas Maduro. According to Hill, this action is merely a pretext for a failed policy which goes beyond targeting Venezuela specifically and instead seeks to destabilize Latin America.
Tens of thousands of people have marched through Australia's major cities and towns, organizers said, demanding action to save dying and starving Palestinians. More than 40 protests took place across Australia on Sunday, according to the group Palestine Action, including large turnouts in state capitals, Sydney, Brisbane, and Melbourne. Now, we demand actions in the same way we acted in times of genocide. We are signatories to the Genocide Convention, which means that we have an obligation to prevent and punish genocide when it occurs. Protests denouncing Israel's war and starvation campaign were also held in several other countries on Sunday. In Australia, where people rallied in cities of all sizes nationwide, protesters urged sanctions against Israel and urged an end to arms trade with the country. Organizers estimated that more than 300,000 people participated in the demonstrations. In other news around the world, protests came after the world's leading authority on food crises, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, officially declared a famine in Gaza City. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification said more than 500,000 people, over 500,000 in Gaza, about a quarter of its population, face catastrophic levels of hunger, many at risk of dying from malnutrition. Protests also took place in support of Palestine in Malaysia, Kenya, Belgium, and Senegal. Over the weekend, demonstrations took place in the UK, United Kingdom, and Sweden. A mass rally was held in Malaysia's capital, Kuala Lumpur, seeing thousands of people demonstrating, calling for Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim who said the demonstration would act as a starting point to form a group of activists to take humanitarian aid to Gaza later this month. In Senegal's capital, Dakar, demonstrators condemned Israeli attacks on Palestinians, called for humanitarian aid to be allowed in to Gaza. Then in Nairobi, Kenya, hundreds of bikers rallied, chanting, "Free Palestine! Free Palestine!" Many decried the international community for its inability to stop Israel's deadly assault. An unprecedented coalition of former EU and national ambassadors, along with senior ex-officials, has signed a new open letter urging the EU to take tougher action against Israel amid the deepening humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The joint letter, signed by 209 former European ambassadors and officials, includes 74 former ambassadors representing the EU overseas and 96 former national ambassadors from Germany, France, and Italy. The letter from the European Union officials expressed profound disappointment that the European Union had taken no substantive measures to pressure Israel to put an end to its brutal war in Gaza. The open letter argued that if the EU cannot reach a joint agreement on action against Israel, a coalition of like-minded states should proceed with their own sanctions against the Zionist regime. The signatories also criticized the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza, no flow at all, describing it as totally inadequate. If this is not bad enough, the Integrated Food Security Phase classification confirmed on the 22nd of August that a man-made famine now exists in these same areas in Gaza, with 500,000 people facing starvation, destitution, and death. The open letter to the EU condemned Israeli plans to expand illegal settlements in East Jerusalem, calling it openly declared aim to sabotage the long-standing two-state solution, backed by the vast majority of the United Nations member states and the European Union officially. It further denounced the actions of violent settlers who continue to run amok in the occupied West Bank. The letter has been addressed to European Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen, European Council President Antonio Costa, and European Parliament President Roberta Metsola. Pro-Palestine activists have called for legislation granting Ireland the authority to block the sale of Israeli war bonds on human rights grounds. Activists argue that the bonds help fund the genocide in Gaza, and Ireland has an obligation under the Genocide Convention to employ all possible measures to deter parties suspected of participating in a genocide.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website works well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to work harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. This shortwave report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the shortwave report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from spinal injuries and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.